Okay, I think we're gonna get started, everyone.
Ready to.
What an exciting night. I'm actually gonna just a much anticipated event. It's such an honor to again return, not virtually this year, but in person, the Hemingway Summer Poetry Series. I feel like that just deserves a round of applause. So like I said, we are celebrating week one of the Hemingway Summer Poetry Series. Tonight's focus is on poetry of the past Pittsburgh poets, Lucy Brock-Broido, Patricia Dobler, Jack Gilbert, Etheridge Knight, and Gertrude Stein. Their work will be read by contemporary Pittsburgh writers Arlen Hess, Anne Rashid, Scott Silsby, Benita Lee Penn, and Celeste Gainey. And as a reminder, Hemingway's will take place in person at White Whale all summer, and we are looking forward to seeing you again in the future. Before I go ahead and tell you a little bit about myself and White Whale quickly, I really do want to thank Joan Bauer and Chris Collins. Everyone give them a round of applause. And I also want to just take a moment to honor a former Hemingway's poet who is no longer with us, Jimmy Savedic. Just a quick round of applause for Jimmy. I didn't have the pleasure of getting to know him super well, but I do know that he was very important and very beloved, and I do have a great deal of respect for him, and I just want to hold that space for just a moment. Okay, so a little bit about myself and White Whale quickly. I'm Halsey, the events coordinator at White Whale Bookstore. For those of you who don't know, White Whale Bookstore is a family-owned, general-interest independent store located in the Bloomfield neighborhood of Pittsburgh. Our store motto is conversation, community, and culture, and we strive to be a home for book lovers. Our events programming features local, national, and international writers and translators reading, discussing, and celebrating literature of all genres for all ages. A few events coming up that we think you might be interested in. On Thursday, May 5th at 7 p.m., come celebrate some spring releases from WVU Press. We'll be joined online for a reading and conversation by Mark Powell, author of the novel Lioness, and Charles Dodd White, author of the collection of essays A Year Without Months. And then we're stoked to welcome R.B. Mertz back to Pittsburgh on Saturday, May 7th at 7 p.m. this Saturday to celebrate the publication of Burning Butch, a memoir, and they'll be joined by Billy Wayne Coakley for a reading and conversation. And just a little fun fact, limited edition Burning Butch matchbooks are available. I know, a very interesting pre-order gift. So please come by, come grab your Burning Butch matchbook. Totally appropriate. And we'll see you on Saturday. And then on Tuesday, this upcoming Tuesday, next week, May 10th at 7 p.m., join us in the store for Ashley Bell Peterson's acclaimed novel, The Crocodile Bride, out in May from Hub City Press. And she'll be joined by local author Irina Rain for a reading and conversation. Again, another nifty pre-order campaign. They are having a special edition enamel crocodile pins. So for every for the first 50 books ordered. So if you want a crocodile pin, could be the right time. Anna said that that book was fabulous, so I highly recommend picking up that book too. You can find out more about these events and RSVP if they're online at whitewhalebookstore.com. And hello to those of you tuning in from home. We did have quite a few on the live stream, so hi. So they are in the space with us as well. We appreciate you being virtually here with us tonight. Also, those of you who showed up physically as well, so welcome. A few notes about the protocol for tonight. We do ask that you keep your masks on at all times. Authors and hosts will remove their masks while they're at the mic, similar to how I am right now. The restrooms are behind me. Right here, you can see the restroom sign right above the corridor. So just hold off until hold off heading back there until the event has ended. But if it's an emergency, of course, take care of your body. And then the door at the back of the cafe is locked. So just as a heads up, you can enter through and exit through the other side. So just keep that in mind. And then I believe that that is it. You're welcome to hang out for a bit at the end of the event and browse our whole stock. Please feel free to ask Anna, myself, or anybody else that you see who works here at the bookstore if you have any questions, want any recommendations. We're always happy to do it, especially if you're looking for local writers. We're celebrating tons of local writers tonight. We have an entire local section right behind you. And I think that that is all from me. I'm going to turn things over to Chris.
Sorry for anybody. Joan is coming up after me. Sorry, Joan, for raising that up like that. Hi. Wow, in person. Who would have thought? It's been a while. Thanks for coming out. Thanks for being here in person tonight, in spite of the tornado warning. We appreciate that. Joan and I were talking earlier. It wouldn't be Hemingway's without at least one evening dominated by an Old Testament deluge. So it's in keeping. It feels like we're back, which is great because we were away for a while. And this particular reading, in fact, was supposed to happen 2 years ago. We had actually pretty much scheduled the whole thing, and then, I don't know, something weird happened. Remind me what that was later. So we canceled it, and then we took a year off, and then a white whale came riding in on their white horse and really saved our season last year. And again, they offered to host us in person so we could make sure everybody felt safe and comfortable. And that was hard to do in the back room of a college bar, as you can understand. So feel free, if you have a beer, pour it on the floor, get really homely. I'm sure Adam and Jill want us to do that. So, and yeah, really, thanks for coming. And thanks for you guys tuning in on the live stream. If you're not here, you're missing Halsey's awesome Scully tattoo, which it's a reason to come back. It really is an awesome tattoo.
Thank you.
But reason to come see us again next time, 2 weeks from now. Okay. All right. Enough of that. So I'm Chris Collins, co-host. I'm Joan's minion. And so, like I said, this particular reading was put together 2 years ago, more than 2 years ago, really. And we really wanted to kind of kick off a season by paying tribute, paying homage to the Pittsburgh writers who came before us, who, when I was a young writer, 15, 16 years old in high school, starting to write poetry, I had no idea there were Pittsburgh writers. That was a foreign idea to me completely. I thought writers came from New York and San Francisco. And that was it, really. If you were a writer, that's where you had to be. So I was much more interested in being a writer from Pittsburgh than being a writer in Pittsburgh. So I really wanted out because I saw no continuity, nowhere to go, no examples to run with. So it seemed certainly personally important to me that we do a reading like this and show what that continuity looks like. And thinking about this reading tonight, it brought to mind this bit. This little bit right here that I wrote down so I could get it right, that I had been thinking about years ago in my writing, and I thought it was apt for tonight. So this comes from the author Patrick Horsburgh. I'm probably not pronouncing his name right. I apologize for that. But he wrote Pittsburgh Perceived, a critical review of form, features, and feasibilities of the prodigious city, which was a study commissioned by the Department of City Planning back in 1963 for Pittsburgh. And he wrote this, essentially. In Pittsburgh, the topographic form and the consequences thereof are inescapable. They condition every action. They confine every vista. They expose every prospect. And I think that's what our writers do, essentially. We follow the topography of the city. We are as much a part of the way the city is built from the landscape to the architecture, the rivers, the fountains, all of it informs who we are, whether we stay or whether we leave. It's a continuity. Now, as writers, we exist in just this one moment in time. So we get to explore it and write about it, feel it, live it, and then we're done. Whether we want to be or not, we have no real say in that. But the writing is a different thing. The writing does not exist in time the way we do. We are in this point. We live from here to here, and that's it. The writing, however, begins here and then starts talking to the writers of the past and the writing of the past. And it also moves into the future and talks to the writers that are coming up behind us and the people who come and live here and experience it and feel it. The writing gets to exist all across time, no matter when it comes into existence. I've worked in enough bookstores and libraries to be able to verify that. The writing is there. The writers might not be, but what we put down on paper, those feelings, those ideas, they are, they remain, and they continue to evolve and speak in ways that we as writers may have never intended or never imagined. But it's important and it's impactful and it changes lives and it's worth doing. So I'm so happy tonight to have these amazing writers who live right now in our moment, that we get to experience them and celebrate their work in conversation with these other authors that they've chosen to read and talk about. It's really a blessing. So on this rainy night, I just want to thank you all for coming. Thank you to Halsey and White Whale. And we're really excited to be here as Hemingways. So thank you very much.
Now, in case you had any questions as to who, why Chris does the intro, you know. thank you, Chris. That was beautiful and deeply thoughtful, and it really helps. It really frames the evening for us. Thank you so much. We are thrilled to be here. And again, thanks to White Whale and to all of you who came out tonight and to all of you who are out there on the Zoom, yes. Thanks for being on the Zoom. And we're really blessed to have five remarkable poets who will be speaking about the lives of five other remarkable poets who are no longer with us, but who are with us forever. So I will introduce each of our poets who's reading tonight and who they will be speaking about. And in a time in which it just feels like the cloud of existential dread follows us around, and we can have a healing night of poetry together. And thank you all for being here. Arlen Hess is the owner of City Books. She hosts Shelf Life, a book show about Pittsburgh authors and topics relevant to Western Pennsylvania, leads arts and literature tours around the old Allegheny West neighborhood, directs the City Books Writers in Residence program. And some of us know her from way back when she was teaching at W&J, and she was the founder and chief editor of Paper Street. And I met her 20 years ago, 21 on the Gore campaign, So she will be speaking tonight about Lucy Brock Broido. Please welcome Arlen Hess.
Thank you, Joan and Chris. Thank you, Joan and Chris. And it's wonderful to be kind of back at Hemingway's, although not really at Hemingway's, but it's great that this is going again. And thanks to White Whale, this is my first time in this new space. So I'm really excited about it. And a little jealous from a bookstore owner's point of view. I was not able to print my introduction to Lucy Brock-Porter at home in a rainstorm. So I'm going to read it from my phone, and then I'm going to read some of her work. And this is mostly in case people in the audience aren't familiar with her work, or people who are zooming in. Lucy Brock-Porter was born in Pittsburgh, was educated at Johns Hopkins and Columbia. She taught at Bennington, Princeton, Harvard, and Columbia, and received NEA and Guggenheim fellowships, as well as awards from the American Poetry Review and the Academy of American Arts and Letters. She wrote four collections of poetry: A Hunger, The Master Letters, Trouble in Mind, and Stay Illusion, which was a finalist for the National Book Award and the National Book Circle's Critic Award. I find her poems to be long, shadowy, very surreal at times, and tend toward the grotesque in the sense of distorted imagery, not like who. Many of her poems are persona poems written in the voices of real people, such as a child survivor of the Move fire in Philadelphia, Edward VI, and a victim of Vesuvius in Pompeii. She also pulls lines, images, or concepts from other writers and weaves those parts of other people's work into her work, and then also will weave her work into their work if the other work is the focus. And as a result, becomes very stream of consciousness and very lyrical. The narrative can be really kind of twisting. Her work is heavily endnoted, and as an academic geek, I love that. So it's not only a joy to read her work, but also a joy to read her footnotes as well, or her endnotes. When I was trying to pull poems for tonight's reading, I was struck by the darkness of her color palette in her books. So many of the poems are set in fall or winter with its browns and grays, that it, this time of year tonight, notwithstanding, as the world is coming back and everything's green and the color yellow is everywhere, which I noticed because I'm allergic to basically everything that's yellow. I tried to pick poems that were lighter and poems that were definitively rooted in Western Pennsylvania, where she grew up. So that's, I'm gonna try to give you an overview of her poems in the style that I've talked about, but also in things that directly link her back to Pittsburgh. Her first book is Hunger. This is called Ohio and Beyond. Towns pass like pretty girls you wish you'd left behind, lifting their skirts gentle against their legs. Ravenna, Elyria, Vandalia, dark-haired beauties who fling their hair like girls do when the weather up and shifts. In Mingo Junction, spring will happen easily. The first warm night hangs on the eaves of the dance hall, drops down to the wooden floorboards, settles in the avocado vinyl of the front porch swing. You met a girl here once in the days when the land rolled back and fields of coal bloomed forth and glistened. Everyone was rich for a little while. She played the jukebox for you here one shiny night in April, curled her cool hand around your fist, danced slow with you. She said, "I found a starfish once in Florida." Dresses stuck to girls' skins differently back then. It wasn't all laid bare. All the way from here to Newfoundland, the rip bop on the car radio carries you, rises like an ether, blue and faint on the road. This is probably her most well-known poem, and this is one of the ones where she's taking on the voice or wrapping her narrative around a real person or a real event. And this is called Jessica from the Well, about little Jessica McClure, who fell down the well when she was 18 months old. She sort of elevates her and mythologizes her. Jessica from the Well. One. This is what it was like. The morning pale all above me, a patch of sky like a blue poker flung into a floor of earth. This is what I have to go on. I am on my knees at first, a Jessica prayer. I pray against the rose caliche, the hard pan rock, a marbling of new wound in my forehead. I've never spoken aloud yet to anyone alive, but I know all the words. On Wednesday morning, I slipped down the shaft like the small mythic creature I have always known I ought to be. No one was looking. I am mutable still. I fold myself. It is a gift to be this small and aboriginal. Even without food, I am growing, and I find this frightful that my body will become too large to live here comfortably. The earth opens for me, as I always knew it would for a wish. Two. All day, I am divined by sunlight, and October has gone damask, ochreous. When I learn a word sometimes, I am compelled to use it. Given my disposition, I will always be circuitous, precocious, and embellisher. Like Oscar, I can make a world change with my voice, can shatter the diamond tips bit of the drill, can make the well's walls glitter back at me. My own voice travels sideways as it zigzags to the Titian center of the earth and curls back up to me like a seamstress's needle against her thimble in the very center of the Taj Mahal. I am the only one alive. By dusk, I'm running out of ways to warm myself. I have warmed myself with myself. My own limbs curled all about me, fetal. Sometimes I am so obvious like that. I sing and somewhere above, they can hear me humming along with myself and myself, a choir of me's. By nightfall, only a small albino fracture will be left of the moon, and I will have lost all light to navigate. Soon I will be famous. Three. By midnight, I can hear my own heart thump against the well, drive for a million miles till it hits the water corrugated by the beating as it ripples back to me. It is instantly recognizable, the way a mother cat knows her own by scent and self-love. It is me. Before this day, my skin was never marred in Quaker pink. My forehead has opened now quite by happenstance, the etching on a wall of an undiscovered cave, unlucky hieroglyph. Take, for instance, my right leg, which by midnight I have accidentally wedged in a notorious and irredeemable position. I hate to be unnatural, especially in personal geometry, and by now the leg has lodged irrevocably up against my face, unbound, unfortunate. There is to be no turning back, and I will sing and think of crying for the first time, so they'll know at last I've blundered. I lean into the rock, a willful child, a little bruised, and if I go out, I will die dreaming. Four. I had forgotten the small news of the night between dreams and waking into the warm, smooth, blown air, shimmying down the oval of the well. In the whole history of song, I know very few. So this is what it's like. I am fixing on the hemp clothesline strung across Aunt Jamie Moore's backyard on last week's laundered sheets, triangled like sails, splashed with hyacinth and vetch, they stiffen in the wind against the Texan cobalt sky. It is dawn. All night long, my eyes widened to accommodate the lack of light, a self-illumined glowfish flat on its side. I keep my flicker constant, wide awake while sleeping, both eyes ajar. Big, gangly, weepy, gamey men, sweethearts and insomniacs keep prodding me to sing. And I sing. And move your foot for me, Juicy. And I wiggle it back and forth for the man. And how does a kitten go? And I go like a kitten goes. On and on in that throaty, liquid, lewd, bull-legged voice like kittens make, then shut these big old eyes. Five. Someday I will be buried above ground like Monroe, vaulted always in the midst of flowers and sentiment. On the descent, I was magically compact, boneless. As agile as water itself, always on the way toward other water. The noise of my own form against the loosening walls, I am born into the dark rococo teratogenic rooms of the underground. All the noise of the world stops here and muffles me. This town knows how to drill. Sometimes my imagination gets to running wild. Bring me back alive. It was so simple to come down. I wake with my own hair wound into my fists. In sleep, I've torn my own self, pretty milky curls, a spool of me. In the matter of my toes, there has been damage done, but when I come back, they'll pinken up, I'm sure. In America, hard work and prayer. Resilience is bliss in the body, the voodoo of immunity, the will to come back, deliverance. 6. Surrounded by jelly, an accoutrement of arrows for ascent from the well, I am born. Wide-eyed and swaddled in white linens, I emerge pristine and preserved, like some Egyptian form accompanied and gifted, with all the Nilotic charms necessary for the long quicksilver moments of the afterlife. So this is it. I rub my eyes in news light as if awakening from the mere corn yellow husks of slumber of an ordinary late day nap. The heart is left in situ. I am lifted from the oubliette, divined by water, blinking by air. I cannot speak a word yet, but I know them all. I sing, holding a piece of myself in my hand. It is hair and fear and church bells muscle against each other, and the earth opens for me, as I always knew it would for a myth. Given my character, I will always be mercurial, a little sentimental, star-shaped and terrestrial, divine by water, healed by air, luminescent, inconceivable, a prayer, a Jessica. I sing. That took a lot longer than I thought it was going to, right? Any time left at all? I have one more poem.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. All right, hang on here.
Okay, but of course, when I was reading that and timing it to myself, it just didn't take me that long. Okay, I'm gonna skip. So let me just tell you quickly. This second book that she did called The Master Letters is a riff off of Emily Dickinson's Letters to the Master that was born after her death. And so a lot of those are really lettery. I'm not gonna read any of those. I'm just going to skip right to this great poem at the end of the illusion called Hello Babies. Okay, so trust me, there's not a lot of Pittsburgh in her stuff, but the stuff that is about Pittsburgh is often about fishing with her father. Okay. Hello Babies, welcome to Earth. At the theme park in Homestead, past the steel mills along the Allegheny River's crinkled bank, I went back home to see if I could grok the way the children felt about the hurdy-gurdy man, his lugubrious sweet music, his little capuchin with pinstripe train conductor's cap held out. It was a time in the world that was the snowball's one last season on its way to hell. The earth loved us a little, I remember, said the note pinned in the seersucker left breast pocket of the surrealist suit on his way to Cincinnati then by rail. Small chippy dogs would follow him. He carried bones of milk and scrap. Only some of us have opposing thumbs, but not to worry now. Pop it, if you've anything to say, you should say it soon, I think. So, thank you.
Oh my gosh, that was so good. Thank you so much. So good. And that really involves some research that was, you know, maybe. Pam Rashi is a professor of English and director of women's and gender studies at Carlo University. She has published Poetry in Pittsburgh City Paper, Patterson Literary Review, Pittsburgh Quarterly, Fourth River, Samsonia Way. She and her co-translator have published translations of Korean poetry in multiple journals. Her essay, Lucille Clifton and Claudia Rankine's Elegiac Poetics of Nature, was recently published in Revisiting the Elegy in Black Lives Matters Era Anne is going to be sharing the poetry of Patricia Jobler. Hi, everyone. Oh, so used to having that on. It's really lovely to be here, and thank you, everyone. Thank you, Joan. Thank you to Chris for asking me to be here. So I unfortunately didn't have a chance to meet Pat Jobler because I came in 2008 to Pittsburgh and she died in 2004. But her spirit is so much a part of the building that I teach in at Carlo University. And her picture hangs on the wall in the Mad Women room. And I feel like she's watching over us and her spirit is with us in a very, very big way. But those of you who don't know or never have heard about Pat, I just want to read a little bit about her just so you have a little context. Patricia Jobler was born in Middletown, Ohio in 1939. She is the author of UXB, from Milhunk Books, and Talking to Strangers from University of Wisconsin Press, which won the Brittingham Prize in Poetry. She also completed a third full-length collection called Now. Jobler lived in Pittsburgh, where she taught at Carlo College at the time. It was a college, now it's university, and directed the Women's Creative Writing Center. And she died in 2004. And I love this quote that Maxine Heumann wrote about her. Jobler's view of her origins is free of sentimentality or idealization, but full of feeling. Images, sounds, smells, sparks of connection fly in these poems. So I've been steeping myself in Pat's work, rereading her poems, and I just want to share some of my favorites with you. And I think they all kind of go together in an interesting way. So I'm just gonna read I hope you enjoy. So this is her first poem actually, called January, in her collected poems. I also wanna mention, she also published her collected poems. I think this is after her death. Right. The collected poems were published by Autumn House Press, if you're interested. So the first poem in this collection is January. More snow, the weather's raw, as if something certain circles near but hides, won't make itself clear. The larger flakes fall upward, the sycamore's slim branch yields to snow. The brief shining of my mother in this world. How is it with her now? It's the wolf moon, mother, and his indifferent eye. On the way to a meeting. In January, my boss asked me if I had seen the full moon the night before, the hunger moon, the wolf moon. We were headed toward a grievance committee. I lied and said yes, because suddenly I could see that other moon hanging as if by a thread over the Bay of Naples, the whole improbable golden orb of it, laying a path we could walk on. How could we not think of love songs with rhymes on the ooh sounds, with that pregnant opulence glistering away? But here I was, having just lied to my boss, because I had lost track of the moon's phases. Hadn't looked out the window in months. Back in June, back in Naples, the slight rain intensified, hibiscus, roses, the various herbs. There were no windows, just hairpin turns and bougainvillea. I had lost track. I didn't know, or do I lie? I didn't want to know how sick she was. She was dying while I was moon gazing. The wolf moon was already eating her. And I stood with my friends drinking wine. If she had known what I was doing, she would have been happy for me, my mother. Her one talent was loving. Mine is grieving. So Pat came from a mill town and understood that work very well. And this poem, I think, is a beautiful poem about her upbringing and her father's work in that mill. the mill in winter. Below them, the valley cradles the mill's dark body, which lay for a decade like a stunned animal, but now awakens, almost innocent again in the morning light. A pale disk of sun pinks the crusted snow the men walk on. The first thin columns of smoke brush the sky, and the odors of coke and pickling acid drift toward them. They taste metal on their tongues and yearn toward the mill's black heart. To enter, to shut out the bright cold air, is to enter a woman's body, beautiful as ashes of roses, a russet jewel, a hot breath grazing their arms and necks. Here's a Pittsburgh poem on Murray Avenue. I don't know the boy who runs toward me holding out his arms. You look so pretty, he shouts, and grabs me round the shoulders. I see that only his mind is young. Some mother's hand still combs his hair, though it's graying. But maybe he chose the red t-shirt. It looks brand new. And if my heart were less a closed fist, I would not shudder out of this sidewalk two-step. I'd hug him back, tell him he looks pretty too. How to winter out. Love the landmass, the enclosure of a continent around you. Think of yourself as the hot center. Remember frostbite, how the blood rushes from hands and feet to save the heart. Do likewise, pare down to the vital. Do without color except the necessary cardinal on a branch, a spot of blood on snow, a burning coal. But dream when you sleep and dream in color. Do not tell your lover your dreams unless he asks. Then embroider, otherwise do not adorn. Make love without speaking, make love in Spanish, speak in tongues, but use no names. May morning to WCW. Flick, flick. There his line goes again over the backyards of Pittsburgh. My neighbor practices fly casting, leans from his second story porch, just misses the tangle of last year's nests and the peeved sparrows as he spins out the thread, flirting it over the green bushy banks where imaginary trout lurk and flash, hanging in pools under the peony bushes. Oh, mingle of hope and desire, fish of our dreams. While in the backyard burns that green broken bottle color deep as the sea, and the scent of our three brown rivers wafts over the Semper Vivum, those little cabbage plants round as roses. Just a couple more. So hard to, am I okay? Okay, okay. Yeah, don't want to skimp on Pat. They're still wonderful. Okay, a couple more. Dark trail. I wasn't lost. No one could get lost on such manicured trails, but without a moon and caught between the parties and the house's lights, I stood inside the heart of a tree, or maybe inside the sky. I could have been suspended anywhere, feet moving over, not on, pine needles blowing down. Whatever was left between feet and head was probably my body, which ignited a luminous raft, a dream of flying or floating face down, hair adrift in the pool's gel. It's good to die a little. Nothing is taken away. If you and I were together again on the paddle boat, we could fly our dragon kite, letting it follow the boat attached by the thinnest wire. Lovely to tug on the line, to feel it strong, tense to break away. Pluck it, you hear music higher than wind in these trees, burning their incandescent inward lights. Love and work. Six or eight swallows dip to the pond's green glass, skimming for midges which rise to meet them. The swallows double in the calm surface like an eddy of leaves caught by the wind in a pattern that looks like art but isn't,
just a beautiful accident of clear water and the embroidering birds. But when love and work combine, there is no difference. I had a friend whose life moved like these birds, and if ever he entertained one fake notion about himself or art, love, or work, I never knew it. As everything floats away, the swallow's liquid calls, upborne over the pond. I remember his soft chant, so be it, so be it. Thank you.
Oh my gosh, Anne, that was beautiful. Thank you so much. That is a wonderful book. It's a wonderful book. Scott Silsby, we think of as being a longtime Pittsburgher, but he was in fact born in Detroit. He now lives in Wilkinsburg, and his poems and prose have appeared in numerous periodicals and have been collected in four books. Unattended Fire, The River Underneath the City, Muskrat Friday Dinner, and Meet Me Where We Survive. He is also assistant editor at Low Ghost Press, and he will be sharing tonight the poetry of Jack Gilbert.
Thanks. I'd like to thank White Whale for having us and Halsey. And I'd like to thank Chris and Joan for asking me to read. I'm going to read a handful of Jack Gilbert poems and then talk about Jack and my connection with his work, and then finish off with a few more Jack Gilbert poems. Poetry is a kind of lying. Poetry is a kind of lying, necessarily, to profit the poet for beauty, but also in that truth may be told only so. Those who admirably refuse to falsify, as those who will not risk pretensions, are excluded from saying even so much. Degas said he didn't paint what he saw, but what would enable them to see the thing he had. Trying to be married. Watching my wife out in the full moon, the sea bright behind her across the field and through the trees. 8 years and her love for me quieted away. How fine she is, how hard we struggle. Tear it down. We find out the heart only by dismantling what the heart knows. By redefining the morning, we find a morning that comes just after darkness. We can break through marriage into marriage. By insisting on love, we spoil it, get beyond affection and wade mouth deep into love. We must unlearn the constellations to see the stars. But going back toward childhood will not help. The village is not better than Pittsburgh. Only Pittsburgh is more than Pittsburgh. Rome is better than Rome in the same way the sound of raccoon tongues licking the inside walls of the garbage tub is more than the stir of them in the muck of garbage. Love is not enough. We die and are put into the earth forever. We should insist while there is still time. We must eat through the wildness of her sweet body already in our bed to reach the body within that body. Finding something. I say moon as horses in the tempered dark because horse is the closest I can get to it. I sit on the terrace of this worn villa the king's telegrapher built on the mountain that looks down on a blue sea and the small white ferry that crosses slowly to the next island each noon. Michiko is dying in the house behind me. The long windows open so I can hear the faint sound she will make when she wants watermelon to suck, or so I can take her to a bucket in the corner of the high-ceilinged room, which is the best we can do for a chamber pot. She will lean against my leg as she sits so as not to fall over in her weakness. How strange and fine to get so near to it. The arches of her feet are like voices of children calling in the grove of lemon trees, where my heart is as helpless as crushed birds. So Jack Gilbert was born in Pittsburgh in 1925 and grew up in East Liberty. In the early 50s, he went to Pitt, where he made friends with Gerald Stern, who inspired him to write poetry. In 1962, at age 37, he won the Yale Younger Prize for his first book, Use of Jeopardy. By the mid-60s, Gilbert retreated to Europe, living in a kind of self-imposed exile and not publishing his second book, Monolithos, until 1982 at age 57. His third book, The Great Fires, came out in 1994. In his later years, the books came in quicker succession, Refusing Heaven in 2005 and The Dance Most of All in 2009. Knopf published The Collected Poems in 2012. Jack Gilbert died later that year at age 87. I first encountered a Jack Gilbert poem in 1996 when I was 18 years old, a freshman in college. My English composition teacher passed out a photocopy of the title poems of The Great Fires to my class. Over the next couple of years, two of my poetry mentors also used poems from The Great Fires in their classes. That was all about 25 years ago now. And I've only become more of a Jack Gilbert fan since then. There's a great seriousness I appreciate about Gilbert, his work, and how he thought of his work. Poetry is not just a game to him. I like how personal Gilbert's poems feel. One thing I know I've learned from reading Jack's work so extensively is that there's a value in documenting the quotidian, the seemingly everyday in poetry. Thanks, Celeste, for the word quotidian. Where was I? Gilbert is able to do this sometimes by capturing or rendering a very brief moment in a short poem, another trick I know I've taken from his work. He was a master of compression and he knew it. In an essay he once wrote, one of the special pleasures in poetry for me is accomplishing a lot with the least means possible. In the fall of 2004, I found an address listed for Gilbert in Northampton, Massachusetts. So I went and found the house and knocked on the door. I asked the man who opened the door, "Is this the Gilbert residence?" And he said, "Well, no, but Jack lives up over my garage." The first thing Jack said to me was, "Why are you here?" I think I answered, "Because I'm a fan of your work and I wanted to thank you." And he said, "No, why are you really here?" And I stumbled, but I said, "Because I'm a poet?" To which he replied, "That's right, you have to say it." He asked me, "You say you're up from Pittsburgh?" And I said that I was. "Are you from Pittsburgh?" he asked me. And I said, "No, I'm from Detroit." To which Gilbert said, "Well, that's like jumping from one smokestack to another." I was surprised when Jack asked me to read him some of my poems. I admitted to being nervous. "I know," Gilbert replied. "I was nervous when I went to visit Pound in the castle. But Pound told me then that he was done reading the work of younger writers. So you can't do a whole lot worse than that." I asked Gilbert if he thought he would publish another book, it having been a decade since The Great Fires had come out. He said that he didn't think so, but that his ex-wife Linda called him every day to convince him that he should. Months later, I sent Gilbert a letter thanking him for visiting with me, as well as a few of my latest poems. I received a postcard in return saying which of the poems he liked most and saying, "I'm sorry I can't write mail. I'm working to finish my new book for next April. Yours, Jack Gilbert." Thanks. Okay, a few more Gilbert poems and then I'm out of here. Failing and flying. Everyone forgets that Icarus also flew. It's the same when love comes to an end, or the marriage fails and people say they knew it was a mistake, that everybody said it would never work, that she was old enough to know better. But anything worth doing is worth doing badly. Like being there by that summer ocean on the other side of the island while love was fading out of her, the stars burning so extravagantly those nights that anyone could tell you they would never last. Every morning she was asleep in my bed like a visitation, the gentleness in her like antelope standing in the dawn mist. Each afternoon I watched her coming back through the hot stony field after swimming, the sea light behind her and the huge sky on the other side of that. Listen to her while we ate lunch. How can they say the marriage failed? Like the people who came back from Provence when it was Provence and said it was pretty, but the food was greasy. I believe Icarus was not failing as he fell, but just coming to the end of his triumph. Waking at night. The blue river is gray at morning and evening. There is twilight at dawn and dusk. I lie in the dark wondering if this quiet in me now is a beginning or an end. Convalescing. I spend the days deciding on a commemorative poem. Not, luckily, an epitaph, a quiet poem to establish the fact of me, as one of the incidental faces in those stone processions, carefully done, not claiming that I was at any of the great victories, but that I volunteered. Thank you.
Oh my gosh, Scott, that was so great. Thank you. Benita Lee Penn is a Pittsburgh poet, literary curator, author of Every Morning is a Foot is Looking for My Neck. Her work has been included in the anthology Where We Stand, Poems of Black Resilience, the Massachusetts Review, Solstice, a magazine of diverse voices and others. She's a member of the experimental performance group, Heroes Are Gang Leaders. Heroes Are Gang Leaders and poetry facilitator for Mad Women in the Attic creative writing workshops. She will be speaking tonight about Etheridge Knight.
Yeah. Hello. Thank you, Joan and Chris, and the Whitewell and Halsey, and all the books in here that are listening to us speak right now. What I'm going to read, of course, is Etheridge Knight. I'm going to give you a little bit about his life, his works, and throw them with some of his poems I hope relate to what I'm saying. Okay, let's go. Let's get to digging his stuff. Okay, he was born April 19th, 1931 in Corinth, Mississippi. The family later moved to Paducah, Kentucky, where his dad found work at the Kentucky Dam. He frequently ran away from home, so his parents sent him back to his cousin's uncle's house in Mississippi. Knight was a very bright child, but he just didn't like school and he dropped out at 16. So he started working as a shoe shiner and spent the rest of his time hanging out in juke joints, pool halls, underground poker games, exposing him to all types of people, their lifestyle, and the language. Hanging out, he was also exposed to the style of Toast, a narrative style oral poetry in story form. If you are not familiar with the likes of Signifying Monkey, Voodoo Queen, or Toledo Slim, you're going to have to pick up this book, Get Off Your Ass in the Water and Swim Like, Get Your Ass in the Water and Swim Like Me by Bruce Jackson. And the title of the poem is from one of Knight's poems. And also there is a CD in the back of the book, so you can really hear these guys do these toasts. And these toasts are filled with sexual stuff, a lot of drug activity, violent stuff, language of the street slang, and obscenities, but they're really funny. And so I will be reading one, so if you are sensitive, please, you know, hold your ears. Okay, in 1947, he enlisted in the Army, the Korean War time. He came back, of course, like everybody else, with the drug addiction. He returned to doing illegal things where he supported his addiction by, you know, robbing. In 1960, he was convicted for 8 years in Indiana State Prison for robbery. And what he said was, I died in Korea for a shrapnel wound and narcotics restituted me. I died in 1960 from a prison sentence and poetry brought me back to life. In prison, he realized that his anger was not doing him well and he started to focus on books. And since Knight was already spitting rhymes in the narrative language and the practices of Toast style and of the Black aesthetic, he chose poetry. So the first one we're going to read, they will all be from the Essential Etheridge Knight. And this one is called Dark Prophecy, I Sing of Shine. This is one of the toasts, so be ready for some language. And yeah, brothers, while white America sings about the unsinkable Molly Brown, who was hustling the Titanic when it went down, I sing to thee of Shine, the stoker who was hip enough to flee the fucking ship and let the white folks drown with screams on their own lips. Jumped his black ass into the dark sea, Shine did, broke free from the straining steel. Yeah, I sing to thee of Shine and how the millionaire banker stood on the deck and pulled from his pocket $1 million check saying, Shine, shine, save poor me, and I'll give you all the money a black boy needs. And Shine looked at the money and looked at the sea and said, jump in, motherfucker, and swim like me. And Shine swam on. And how the banker's daughter ran naked to the deck with her pink tits trembling and her pants around her neck, screaming, Shine, Shine, save poor me. I'll give you all the pussy a black boy needs. How Shine said, now pussy is good, and that's no jive, but you gotta swim up, fuck, to stay alive. And Shine swam on. How Shine swam past the preacher floating on the boat, crying, save me, nigga Shine, in the name of the Lord. And how the preacher grabbed Shine's arm and broke his throat. How Shine pulled his shank and cut the preacher's throat. And Shine swam on. And when the news hit that the Titanic had sunk, Shine was up in Harlem damn near drunk. And while working as a journalist in prison, in 1965, he started to submit his poetry to the Negro Digest. And the Negro Digest was founded in 1942 by the Johnson Publishing Company, which was published locally in Chicago. And the magazine included works by Gwendolyn Brooks, Dudley Randall, Sonia Sanchez, Leroy Jones, Maury Evans, Michael Hopper, Jay Wright, and soon Etheridge Knight. He established contact with these significant poets in the African-American community, such as Dudley and Gwendolyn Brooks, both visited him in prison. Don Lee, who is Hakeem Mahobutu, and Sonia Sanchez. Randall's Broadside Press published Knight's first book, Poems from Prison. The book held him as one of the major poets of the Black Arts Movement. And this next poem is called Sun Came, and this one he's speaking to Gwendolyn Brooks. The sun came, and if sun comes, how shall we greet him, Gwen Brooks? The sun came, Miss Brooks, after all the night years. He came spitting fire from his lips, and we flipped. We goofed the whole thing. It looked like our ears were not equipped for the fierce hammering. And now the sun has gone, has bled red, weeping behind the hills. Again, the night shadow forms. But beneath the placid face, a storm rages. The rays of red have pierced the deep, have struck the core. We cannot sleep. The shadows sing, Malcolm, Malcolm, Malcolm. The darkness ain't like before. The sun came, Miss Brooks, and we goofed the whole thing, I think. So ain't no vision visited me in my cell. In 1968, he was released from prison, and he married Sonia Sanchez. And both were living in Homewood, out there on Hamilton Avenue, I believe, and Sanchez was teaching at Pitt. And during that time, Nat Knight held a position of writer in residence at several universities, including 2 years, 1968 and 1969, at the University of Pittsburgh. In 1970, his marriage to Sonia ended due to his continued drug abuse and violent behavior. But his time in Pittsburgh was important to his writing career. He wrote his third book, Belly Song and Other Poems, which were published in 1973, about his new life and experiences in love. He was nominated for the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. And also during this time, Knight Award was awarded the National Endowment for the Arts in 72 and the Guggenheim Fellowship in 1974. He taught at University of Pittsburgh, University of Hartford, Lincoln University, before his health forced him to stop, and he died in Indianapolis of lung cancer in 1991. Knight's poetry uses Black vernacular, includes a number of haikus among his forms. And one of my favorite haikus is Making Jazz Swing in 17 Symbols Ain't No Square Poet's Job. The next haiku is Vigo County. Beyond the brown hill above the silent cedars, blackbirds flee April rains. Now this poem had a message that aligned with the Black Arts Movement, and that the artists were no longer going to be imprisoned by silence. They would use their voices in art to escape. Craig Werner said that technically, Knight merges musical rhythms and traditional meter devices, reflecting the assertion of Afro-American cultural identity within the Euro-American content. This next one, for Black poets who think of suicide. Black poets should live, not leap from steel buildings like the white boys do. Black poets should live, not lay their necks on railroad tracks like the white boys do. Black poets should seek, but not search too much in sweet dark caves, nor hunt for snipe down psyche trails like the white boys do. For Black poets belong to Black people, are the flutes of Black lovers, are the organs of Black sorrows, are the trumpets of Black warriors. We all Black poets, let all Black poets die as trumpets and be buried in the dust of marching feet. Randall, the founder of Broadside Press, said that Knight focuses on imprisonment as a form of contemporary enslavement and looks for ways in which one can be free despite his incarceration. And Joyce Ann Joyce places Knight in the context of an African philosophy aesthetic tradition. His tribute to the ancestors, she writes, emerges as a ritualistic drama in which the values of the poet's ancestors were reborn, redefined, reaffirmed, and reinterpreted at once, giving them added viability and sacralizing their new form. Prison allowed Knight to merge his personal consciousness with the conscience of Black people influenced by Black folks. A poem for my South, or blues for a Mississippi Black boy. I was born in Mississippi. I walked barefoot through the mud. Born Black in Mississippi, walked barefoot through the mud. But when I reached the age of 12, I left that place for good. Said my daddy chopped cotton and he drank his liquor straight. When I left that Sunday morning, he was leaning on the barnyard gate, left her standing in the yard with the sun shining in her eyes. I was headed north. As straight as the wild goose flies, I've been to Detroit and Chicago, been to New York too. Said I done strolled all those funky avenues. I'm still the same old Black boy with the same old blues. Going back to Mississippi, it's time to stay for good. Going back to Mississippi, it's time to stay for good. Gonna be free in Mississippi or dead in a Mississippi mud. In his poem, Cell Song, Knight articulates his desire to create something good from his time in prison. This will be the last piece that I read. Cell Song. Night, music slanted. Light strike the cave of sleep. I alone tread the red circle and twist the space with speech. Come now, Etheridge, don't be a savior. Take your words and scrape the sky, shake rain on the desert, sprinkle salt on the tail of a girl. Can there anything good come out of prison? Thank you.
Anita, that was so strong. Thank you so much. It was real. In case somehow you didn't know this, Celeste Gainey is the author of The Gapper, cited by O, the Oprah magazine, as one of the 8 new books of poetry to savor in 2015. As well as the chapbook, The Land of Speculation and Seismography. She has been a presenting poet at the Geraldine R. Dodge Poetry Festival and served, as some of you know, as the inaugural Poet Laureate of Allegheny County for City of Asylum from 2020, 2022, I guess that's now. She graduated the BFA from the Tisch School at NYU. I think that's the Tisch School, right? Yeah, the Tisch School. And has an MFA from Carlo University in creative writing. In fact, she came to Pittsburgh to do that program. And Celeste was the first woman to be admitted to the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees as a gaffer, and spent many years working with light in film and architecture. You really have to check out her website if you haven't seen it, because there's so much fun to see her photos of her with Martin Scorsese and other people. It's amazing. It's an amazing website. And tonight, Celeste will be sharing life and poetry, the creative work of Gertrude Stein.
Can you hear me? Is this okay? So thanks, Joan, and thanks, Chris, and thanks, White Whale and Halsey, and Anna. You're still here. Trying to get my stuff out. Have to get arranged here. Okay, you still can hear me, right? Okay. So I'm going to be your school mom tonight, even though it's the last session of the evening. Gertrude Stein was born on February 3rd, 1874, at 850 Beach Avenue in what was then a separate municipality, Allegheny, PA, but is now considered the Allegheny West neighborhood of our dear North Side. And if you walk by there, you can see a plaque in honor of her. I wish it was a writing center, maybe someday. 37 years later, on the very same day, my mother was born in a small town in Minnesota. And 77 years later, on that exact day, I was born in Santa Barbara, California. This is why, of course, Joan asked me to do this. I doubt if my mother appreciated the significance of this coincidence, but I certainly do, and look to Gertrude Stein as both one of the greatest innovators ever working within the English language, as well as my personal literary shaman. Not that I employ Steinisms in my writing, thank God, but in terms of how she boldly forged her own courageous pedagogical path out of the Victorian era into the belly of the male-dominated world of early to mid-20th century arts and letters, she is forever my lodestar. We have so little time tonight to grapple with such a monumental figure as Gertrude Stein, and I want you all to hear a bit of her work as well as a poem inspired by her. So I'm going to rely on seminal feminist lesbian poet Judy Gron and her anthology of critical essays and excerpts from Stein's writings, really reading Gertrude Stein as our guide for this brief treatise. And this is Judy's book. I highly recommend it. Gron's book was published in 1989 and remains a preeminent source for anyone truly interested in opening one's linear-driven mind to Stein, as well as to the capabilities of language if approached from perspectives other than emotion-driven narrative. Gron begins her book's opening treatise with the following. When a person, and especially a woman, calls herself great or the greatest of writers, that is, of idea formers, this is a signal to pay her some attention, since either she is lying or she is telling the truth. And if she is lying, we shall know it soon, as her work quickly fades and her effect never materializes. But if she is telling the truth, her work will gradually expand its influence and power within our culture. Gertrude Stein said that she was great, at least the writer of our century, meaning the 20th century. And others have said that she is comparable to, say, Spinoza, and still others have belittled her and trivialized her work. My intention for this evening, for those of you who haven't yet gotten down with Gertrude, is to ignite your curiosity and entice you to dive into Stein, especially her philosophy about writing, art, and human nature. Her queerness, lifestyle, and some of her controversial stances on the sociological and political issues of her time are well documented elsewhere and have been picked apart by many scholars and pundits. So do not expect me to re-examine those tonight. Rather, simply open your ears, and as John Ashbery has said when queried about his own often abstruse poetry, I don't think it's difficult if one lets a poem approach one the way one hears music. Just let it wash over you.
So that is the first thing I suggest, to just let Gertrude wash over you. The second is to read, if you haven't already, the marvelously engaging and name-dropping autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, hopefully out loud to someone. It's a gas, as that will set the Steinian mise-en-scene for the years of artistic disruption in Paris in the first half of the 20th century, and then pick up Judy Grand's thoughtful primer. I believe if you absorb these two sources, you will be born again as a fan of Stein forevermore. I consider Stein more of a philosopher who writes than a writer who philosophizes. As Grand states in her book, Stein is a writer in ideas, not judgments. They are the thread and fabric of her works. Here are some terms Grand has coined for examining Stein's work, all of which are readily apparent once the reader decides to no longer resist her rhythms and methodologies. Equality, commonality, essence, value, continual present, play, and transformation. As legend tells us, Gertrude became fast friends with Picasso and the other painters living and painting in Montmartre at the beginning of the 20th century, but Gertrude's favorite painter was Cézanne, very much pre-Picasso and often identified as the instigator of post-impressionism or the transition from impressionism to modernism. He put forth a radical theory that everything on the canvas had common importance and composed paintings accordingly. This theory of equality or lack of hierarchy in composition was adapted by Stein and became the bedrock of her writing intention and style. According to Gertrude, all the words in a sentence have equal import. Stein's 1922 story of queerness, before our present understanding of the word existed, or our present meaning of the word gay existed, Miss Fur and Miss Skeen is evidence of her harmonizing a vocabulary and giving events value in and of themselves, of giving all elements of the story equal weight. By doing so, Stein was able to write a story about behaviors at that time considered immoral, decadent, and obscene, but get it published in an era, as Grand states, that would never have published a literal version. Here are the opening paragraphs of Miss Fur and Miss Skeen. Listen for repetition, emphasizing a lack of sensationalism, giving the same-sex proclivities of Miss Fur and Miss Skeen a mundane, everyday, or quotidian, sort of gloss. And I gotta get hydrated for this. Miss Fur and Miss Skeen. Helen Fur had quite a pleasant home. Mrs. Fur was quite a pleasant woman. Mr. Fur was quite a pleasant man. Helen Fur had quite a pleasant voice, a voice quite worth cultivating. She did not mind working. She worked to cultivate her voice. She did not find it gay living in the same place where she had always been living. She went to a place where some were cultivating something, voices and other things needing cultivating. She met Georgine Skeen there, who was cultivating her voice, which some thought was quite a pleasant one. Helen Fur and Georgine Skeen lived together then. Georgine Skeen liked traveling. Helen Fur did not care about traveling. She liked to stay in one place and be gay there. They were together then and traveled to another place and stayed there and were gay there. They stayed there and were gay there. Not very gay there, just gay there. They were both gay there. They were regularly working there, both of them cultivating their voices there. They were both gay there. Georgine Skeen was gay there, and she was regular in being gay, regular in not being gay, regular in being a gay one who was not one being gay longer than was needed to be one being quite a gay one. They were both gay then there and both working there then. They were in a way both gay there, where there were many cultivating something. They were both regular in being gay there. Helen Fur was gay there. She was gayer and gayer there. And really, she was just gay there. She was gayer and gayer there. That is to say, she found ways of being gay there that she was using in being gay there. She was gay there, not gayer and gayer, just gay there. That is to say, she was not gayer by using the things she found there that were gay things. She was gay there, always she was gay there. They were quite regularly gay there, Helen Furr and Georgine Steen. They were regularly gay there where they were gay. They were very regularly gay. To be regularly gay was to do every day the gay thing that they did every day. To be regularly gay was to end every day at the same time after they had been regularly gay. They were regularly gay. They were gay every day. They ended every day in the same way at the same time, and they had been every day regularly gay. Yeah, that's kind of, you can see why I'm not going to read too much of the work. Anyway, so you can really hear the rhythmic nature of Steyn's writing, a very important element for her as well. As she writes in the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, Steyn liked to set a sentence for herself as a sort of tuning fork and metronome, and then write to that time and tune. So these ideas and notions are but a few building blocks and examples of Steyn's sprawling output over the course of nearly 50 years. She died on the operating table in the American hospital just outside Paris in the summer of 1946 at the age of 72 while being operated on for a cancerous tumor in her stomach. Steyn's last words to her longtime companion, Alice Toklas, as she was being wheeled into the operating theater have famously been reported as, "What is the answer?" When Alice replied that there was no answer, Gertrude characteristically quipped, "Then there is no question." Toklas outlived Steyn by a little over 20 years and soldiered on as champion of Steyn's work, but between Alice's spendthrift ways and eccentricities and the state challenges posed by members of Steyn's family to the provisions of Gertrude's will that provided for her companion, Toklas died in Paris in relative poverty and obscurity in 1967. And here we are, a full century after Steyn's beginning brushes with fame, and still her life and her ideas continue to engage us, perhaps now more than ever. Just look to the language poets, to Lynn Hejinian, Ron Silliman, and the likes of poet, novelist, and artist Renee Gladman. Gertrude Steyn is all around us. Her legacy lives on and propagates. And I'd like to close with a terrific poem that pays tribute to Steyn's legacy by another heralded Pittsburgh poet and one of my very favorites, Lynn Emanuel. And this poem, some of you may be familiar with, is called Inside Gertrude Steyn. And there's a mention in this poem of a piece by Gertrude Steyn called Patriarchal Poetry. So just know that when I come upon it. Okay, Inside Gertrude Steyn. Right now, as I'm talking to you and as you are being talked to without let up, it is becoming clear that Gertrude Steyn has hijacked me and that this feeling that you are having now as you read this, that this is what it feels like to be inside Gertrude Steyn. This is what it feels like to be a huge typewriter in a dress. Yes, I feel we have gotten inside Gertrude Steyn, and of course it is dark inside the enormous Gertrude. It is like being locked up in a refrigerator lit only by a smiling rind of cheese. Being inside Gertrude is like being inside a monument made of a cloud, which is always moving across the sky, which is always moving. Gertrude is a huge galleon of cloud anchored to the ground by one small tether. Yes, I see it down there. Do you see that tiny snail glued to the tack board of the landscape? That is Alice. So I am inside. I am inside Gertrude. We belong to each other, she and I. And it is so wonderful because I have always been a thin woman inside of whom a big woman is screaming to get out. And she's out now. And if a river could type, this is how it would sound, pure and complicated and enormous. Now we are lilting across the countryside and we are talking. And if the wind could type, it would sound like this, ongoing and repetitious, abstracting and stylizing everything, like our famous haircut painted by Picasso. Because when you are inside our haircut, you understand that all the flotsam and jetsam of hairdo have been cleared away, like the forest from the new world, so that the skull can show through grinning and feasting on the alarm it has created. I am now alarmingly inside Gertrude's head, and I am thinking that I may only be a thought that she has, that she has had when she imagined that she and Alice were dead and gone, and someone had to carry on the work of being Gertrude Stein. And so I am receiving from beyond the grave radioactive isotopes of her genius saying, take up my work, become Gertrude Stein. Because someone must be Gertrude Stein. Someone must save us from the literalists and realists and narratives of the beginning and end. Someone must be a river that can type. And why not I? Gertrude is insisting on the fact that while I am a subgenius weighing 105 pounds and living in a small town with an enormous furry male husband who is always in his Cadillac Eldorado, driving off to sell something to people who do not deserve the bad luck of this merchandise in their lives, that these facts would not be a problem for Gertrude Stein. Gertrude and I feel that, for instance, in patriarchal poetry, when, like an avalanche that can type, she is burying the patriarchy, still there persists a sense of condescending affection. So while I'm a thin heterosexual subgenius, nevertheless, Gertrude has chosen me as her tool, just as she chose the patriarchy as a tool for ending the patriarchy. And because I have become her tool now, in a sense, Gertrude is inside me. It's tough. Having Gertrude inside me is like having swallowed an ocean liner that can type. And while I feel like a very small coat closet with a bear in it, Gertrude and I feel that I must tell you that Gertrude does not care. She is using me to get her message across to say, I am lost. I am beset by literalists and narratives of the beginning and middle and end. Help me. And so, yes, I say yes. I am here, Gertrude, because we feel, Gertrude and I, that there is real urgency in our voice, like a sob that can type, and that things are very bad for her because she is lost, beset by the literalists and realists, her own enormousness crushing her, and we must find her and take her into ourselves, even though I am the least likely of saviors and have been chosen perhaps as a last resort. Yes, definitely. Gertrude is saying to me, you are the least likely of saviors. You are my last choice and my last resort. Thank you.
Now, it is sadly true that not every poet and lover of poetry in Pittsburgh is here tonight or on Zoom, but we will do our best to let them know about this because we will, YWAL will be kind enough to send us the audio and we will, and Mr. Sterica here, we'll be posting it on the Hemingway's Poetry Series blog, along with the group photo. And so that for years from now, when people want to hear how Pittsburgh poets were remembered, they can listen in and hear what was truly a remarkable evening of poetry. And I just cannot thank you enough. It was brilliant. Now, we had a thunderstorm, possibly a tornado that we might have missed, and an astonishing evening of poetry. And in 2 weeks, there will be another astonishing evening of poetry. And the poets who will be reading I think probably their own work. And they are poets, all of whom were sort of grouped together, clumped together, encouraged to participate together because they have all been editors and publishers. And so, and they are Kelly Andrews, Margaret Bashar, Tim Azayas, Mike Good, and Gwendolyn Mitchell, whom I don't think many of you have heard, and she is so we really just want to remind you of how this all works, is that every other Tuesday night from tonight, every other Tuesday night from tonight through the first Tuesday in August, we are so lucky to have the opportunity to be here and to share poetry with you. So tell your friends, and hopefully more will be on the Zoom next week, next 2 weeks, and more can then listen in later. And I want to say again, thank you to Chris. Thank you to Chris. We do this together. We, you know, put it together. Like, oh, scratching our heads, going, what should we do? Thank you to White Whale, and thank you all of you who braved the tornado to be here tonight, and hope to see you in 2 weeks. Thank you.